Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Flogger Presents with your host, Andrew Walmsley.
Welcome, everybody, to the latest episode. Today I have with me the lovely Rachel from Little Vintage Photography. Hello.
Really nice to be here. Hello. Hello, Andrew. I'm here. yes, it's really nice to be here. Thank you for asking me to come on the show. I've been listening, obviously, last week. I know that you had Paul on from Analog Wonderland.
That's right,
it's really nice to be here to have a little chat today.
He's a great guy. It was such a fun podcast to have. I don't think I'll ever forget King Kong now, so that was quite a nice moment for me. Yeah, so please introduce yourself in your business and let's tell the listeners all about you, if that's okay.
Yeah, no problem at all. So, yes, as you say, I'm Rachel Brewster-Wright and I run a small film photography business called Little Vintage Photography. I work with all kinds of different sort of analog photography, from alternative processes through to, 110, 35mm, medium format, large format, pinhole, cyanotypes, sun prints, salt fixing, all sorts of different, anything that's kind of a bit weird and wonderful, really. I set up Little Vintage Photography about 3 years ago now. Basically, I came to photography for the first time when we were originally using film and in the darkroom. But it was at the point where I was just about to leave art college. So I did my A-level in photography at art college. And then the sort of digital age came in at just at that point. So I was really lucky in that I was able to spend time in the darkroom and learning how to print and that kind of thing. But then digital took over. So we couldn't afford a camera. My dad sold all his old lovely film cameras so to help me buy a digital camera, which obviously I'm gutted about now because I have none of those that he's been able to pass on to me, unfortunately. The only thing that I have left is the old Pentax like hard case box that it all used to sit in. So we've got the old box and the case, but none of the cameras, unfortunately. But anyway, so that was what happened, as you know, sort of like late 90s sort of thing. And then I went off to university and did a video production degree. And after that, ended up running the sort of technical department at the university in Liverpool for a number of years. Eventually left there and went to run a video production company at Staffordshire University. And unfortunately, they had a bit of a reshuffle. The sort of general sort of structure changed and I ended up with 1 month's pay and unfortunately redundant from the post. So at that point I thought, oh God, what the heck are we going to do? You know, it was definitely much more of a falling off a cliff rather than a leap of faith. But I'd already kind of started having the idea of setting something up that I wanted to do more for me, really.
Okay.
I'd been working on sort of like underground, if you like, trying to kind of get things going with the small business as it was, and yeah, really, it ended up being that because this happened, I ended up just sort of thinking, well, I'd applied for so many jobs, you know, it was just ridiculous, and I wasn't getting interviews for jobs that I'd done like all my life, and it was just a really bad period of time. So I thought, well, you know, it's sink or swim, isn't it? I just have to give it a go and see what happens. And yeah, it was it's definitely not all been roses, but I've absolutely loved doing what I do now. And my only regret is that I didn't do it sooner, to be honest. I really, really enjoy it. It's king. So it wasn't all roses, unfortunately, setting up, but my biggest regret really was not taking it up sooner, not kind of like taking that leap and doing it sooner, really, because I absolutely love what I'm doing now. And I'm very fortunate that the variety keeps things interesting. I'm often doing, several different things all in, one day, or during the course of 1 week, I could be all over the place doing lots of different things, which keeps things interesting for me. So really that's kind of how I kind of came to setting up the business in the first place. I just kind of got to the point where I thought, well, I want to do something that I will still want to be doing in 20 years time, 30 years time, it's more about it being a job as a passion rather than a job as, just as a job, if you like, because we spend so much of our lives at work and doing things for work, we might as well enjoy it, is kind of really where I came to it from, and all that. So it's probably a lot of cliches, but that is how I felt about it, really. So it's just really nice anyway, that I've kind of got to the point where I feel like I'm starting to get some jobs coming back in, a bit more of like repeat work and things. Okay. And these things just take time, to get to that point.
So how long have you been doing this then, Rachel?
So the business, like I said, I've probably been doing the business, had the business for about 3 years. I mean, I took my first photograph when I was about 3 years old. I think my dad was in the RAF, you see, so he was like, okay. This is how photography works. So you make a camera out of a box and that kind of stuff. So I always found that, kind of like really fascinating. In terms of actually running the business and kind of coming back to photography, if you like, I had a big hiatus in the middle where I was going much more towards video production and film and moving image, if you like. So it's been really lovely to kind of come back to it, really. So that's where I am now.
You're going to say, you said some very interesting things in there. Large format that just says exciting all to me. I very nearly bought a large format last year.
Oh, which one?
There was probably only one available. I mean, I literally know nothing about them, but I bought a Bronica the year before. And then I was thinking, wow, I can get even bigger. And it was only 200, 250.
Yeah, so fantastic.
Yeah, but I didn't. Mm-hmm. Because I had a look at how much paper was.
Yes, that's the thing. To be honest, in terms of large format, I've got my camera from 1900, Albert. He's a wet plate camera. I obviously would use him. I have my 5x4 pinhole, Ilford Obscura pinhole. Which I love, and I tend to use with photographic paper, which is relatively cheap. So I would suggest something like that is probably a really good way of getting into large format, as a starting point. You can literally make a large format paper negative with a black box and a piece of photographic paper that might cost you, 30p perhaps.
Okay.
So that might be a good way of starting large format, and then you can kind of build up from there. Now, Aid and Graham, who run the podcast with myself, Aid has a Bronica, so at some point I'm sure you'll get a chance to chat to them as well, and he'll be able to tell you all about his love of his Bronica as well, I'm sure. And Graham has a large format monorail camera as well, so he's just sort of got into large format himself as well. So Graham has his large format monorail camera, I'd say Ronald, obviously all our cameras have names. Well, Graham and I name our cameras. I'm not sure if Aid names his cameras, actually. I'll have to find out. You see, I name them all because they all have different personalities and things they like to do and things they really don't like
to
do.
That's definitely true, yeah.
I think with all of us, especially as we get a bit older, like the cameras, it's like, oh no, I'm not doing that anymore, thanks. Like, I'm not sleeping on a futon anymore. That's it, my days of that are over.
Yeah,
thanks.
Same here.
So, sorry, what was I saying? Yeah, so Graham's got his large format
monorail, but it's a big beast of a camera, you see. So I really like shooting with large format. I have my wet plate, my old wooden one from 1900. But I also use 4x5 Ilford Obscura, which is a pinhole, and I shoot photographic paper in that as well as film. So you can actually create images from very, very cheap, you know, for a very, very cheap amount. Okay. Really. So I'd say maybe if you're interested in starting large format, but don't want to invest a lot of money sort of straight away, just have a go with some photographic paper, you know, build literally a pinhole out of a shoebox if you want, you know, that kind of thing, and have a go with that, because that'll cost you pennies really to do that. And pop it in some trays, you know, develop stock fix, and you'll have a large format negative. You know, before you know it, and it won't cost you very much at all. The downside to that is that you will quite quickly get addicted to it, and then you will end up spending a lot of money on all the other fancy things that you can do with large format. So I was lucky enough to have a beta test large format camera from Steve Lloyd, who runs Chroma Camera. I don't know if you've come across
them. Yet, no.
Comes from an engineering background, and he designed this large format camera, which was made from acrylic. So it's really nice and light. And I went to Steve and said, look, I've got this project coming up in Birmingham. Do you mind if I, you know, I kind of like use a beta test, because he wanted people to, you know, sort of go out and put the camera through its paces and things. So I took that along with my Ilford Obscura pinhole as well, up onto the roof of a what I call a skyscraper, high-rise building in Birmingham, to shoot. Yeah, I'd say it was over 24 floors, I think. So, you know, still pretty high, and I was scaling it on the side of a building with a ladder, but with a large format camera, two large format cameras slung over my shoulder. it was in the deepest, darkest part of November, so it was not the ideal time to be up on a roof. Because I only had like 3 hours of daylight each day, and I had 2.5 days to shoot these images. So each shot took me about half an hour by the time, obviously, I'd loaded the camera, got it set up, was hanging onto the tripod with one hand, was hanging onto my phone with the timer with the other hand, and obviously checking my pinhole exposure and that, all the rest of it, with a third, you know, hand holding various bits down with a foot, you know, this kind of thing, and trying to get it all done before the light disappeared. So and then obviously once you've made the exposure, then popping it into the dark bag, taking that sheet out, reloading it with the next one, all the while you can't feel your hands because it's frozen solid. Because it's very cold. So I think each shot took me about half an hour. But actually from that project, I still have a lot of film kind of left in the box, even from a box of like 25 sheets, just simply because there wasn't time to get through it all, to shoot it all. So I think in the end I made about 10 to 15 exposures, and I chose 5 out of those, which I then... Eventually, I'd created those as cyanotype overlays from the original film negatives, and then blew those up to sort of like 3 meters wide by like 2 meters high. So they're in the commercial building in Birmingham, basically on the walls there. So, you know, you can literally start pinhole from, you can start large format from not very much money at all. You don't need very much. You know, I was literally using photographic paper and a little bit of FP4 for those. But I tested it with photographic paper first in my Obscura, because it was really cheap to do that. And then you just do a bit of tray developing, you know, develop stock fix, and you've got your large format negative.
Okay.
So it's nice and straightforward. It doesn't have to be overcomplicated. And there are some really fantastic price points now for entering the large format market. So once you've built your own first pinhole and you've got addicted to it, then actually the nice thing is that there are lots of Kickstarters happening at the moment. I've mentioned Steve's, obviously with his Chroma camera. There's also Intrepid. They do an excellent price point as an entry level to large format. There's another one that's come out in the last couple of weeks.
Yes, seen that.
So there's plenty around. Yeah, so you know, it's it doesn't have to be as intimidating or as expensive as you might think it is to begin with. But you know, it's just also about using the right tool for the right job, isn't it? You know, not every job or not every shoot you're going to be wanting to use large format. You know, you might want to, if you're hiking up a mountain or something, you know, or you know, you're doing some street photography, you probably aren't going to be using large format. I mean, I'm not saying you wouldn't at all, because I know that there are definitely people who do that and like to push the boundaries and things. But you know, it's, then you might be using something that's a bit lighter and a little bit less conspicuous. But yeah, so it's about using the right tool for the right job. But knowing that you've got all these amazing possibilities, really, with analog, I think is what drew me to it in the first place. You can make photographs with like with nothing, you know, with sunshine and some chemicals, and it's just magical. I always found it so magical.
Yeah, I think probably for myself and probably for some listeners who not even done film, it's quite strange, intimidating, because how would we start, say, like large format? Like you say, you're going to have a massive negative. What do you do with that then?
So if you've got a large negative, there are obviously ways you can deal with those now. If you've got a scanner, great. If you've got one of Hamish's new, also Kickstarter, sort of products, which he's basically just brought out recently, and that's been, you know, flying off the shelves, because it's this is exactly the question and the problem that a lot of people came up with, was what do I do with this now I have now I have this huge negative. One thing that I've done is I bought a light pad for 15 quid and just literally lay my negative over that, used my digital camera to take a shot straight down of it. There you go. Done.
Right, okay, you've done it that way as well. Yeah,
absolutely. So whatever works. I mean, you know, if you're going to be printing up, I wouldn't suggest you necessarily have to be printing up in the darkroom from a large format negative. There's a lot of hybrid techniques that come into play with a negative when it's that sort of size. Intrepid, actually, I spoke to with Graham and Aid on our podcast a couple of weeks ago. And they were saying that they're in the middle of launching a kind of add-on, or I've not seen it myself in person, but the idea is that you can use the camera itself as an enlarger, as a way of actually being able to then print from your large format negative from the camera itself. Yeah. So it means that you've not got a whole extra large enlarger, huge enlarger that you would necessarily need to create a print from it. So you know, there's a lot of innovation out there, and there's lots of things and ways around it and that kind of thing. So you've got something like Hamish's Pixlator, if you want to go down the hybrid route where you've got your film negative or paper negative and you want to put on a light pad and take a shot using a digital camera. You've got apps on your phone which will do like an instant inversion. I tend to use those as like a quick way of seeing what I've got. So there's a chap called Abe Fettig who created something called Film Lab. So on my mobile phone, I literally just have the app for that. And I lay my 35mm or whatever negatives on my light pad, my 15 quid light pad, and then hold my phone over it and it'll instantly invert it, so I can see which ones are worth scanning, you know, spending that bit more time on or what have you, and which ones maybe haven't quite exposed properly. So I'm not taking a lot of time on perhaps some shots that actually haven't worked. I'd rather spend more time on printing up or scanning in the ones that have worked, of course. So, you know, you've got the hybrid option or you've got the straight to print option, which, as I say, you know, Intrepid are looking at bringing out now. So there's lots of options there.
Sounds really interesting. Yeah, really, really interesting, because it's a big step into it, because obviously anyone in the digital world thinks full frame is big. And I just say to him, no, look at my camera. This is what you call a big camera.
Exactly.
One of my friends was kind enough to do me a scan at university, and it was, I think, 100 meg. just off the Bronica, and I was like, this is massive. This must have took you a while. He went, yeah, it took me half an hour per scan. Yeah. I was like, wow.
Yeah, these ones I was creating from, you know, for this artwork in Birmingham, I mean, the files were like 2 gig each. Yeah. So this is why, you know, like creating an artwork like that, because of the size it was going to be blown up to and the detail and all the rest of it, you know, it meant that I was working with 9 files that were like that sort of size, which was just crazy. But it was what was needed for that particular job, you know, for that client to produce the work that they were after. But yeah, absolutely. You know, if you're doing a contact print, you, I mean, the lovely thing is from, you know, a medium format, especially upwards, you can create simply a contact print, and that's a beautiful thing just as an object on its own. So if you've got your medium format negative that you've shot in your Bronica, if you get some photographic paper, blast it with a bit of white light, then you've got a really lovely, you know, 6x6 in, you know, sort of actual object there, haven't you? You know, that you can treasure and frame, you know, a little miniature.
I mean, for me, this is all brand new, you see, so I don't have any prior history with photography at all. So I'm coming in really now, really, really into the film side.
I know that you deal with kind of all sorts of photography, not just film. Yeah, absolutely. So I know where you sort of like coming from, going, oh God, it might feel a bit intimidating. Honestly, like, all you have to think about is 3 things, your ISO, your aperture, your shutter speed, and you can make an image.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, I think, honestly, we kind of overcomplicate things often. You know, and really part of me setting up Little Vintage Photography was about trying to simplify things a little bit to give people confidence again that actually you don't need very much to make a photograph. I find it like so exciting and pretty cool that you can make an image, you know, like in a bunker or on the top of a building, or, you know, in a barn or in a field or whatever. You don't need loads of things, you know. I mean, if I can make a photo in a, you know, tumble down barn with holes in the ceiling and, you know, no running water and stuff, you know, you can make an image anywhere, pretty much.
Yeah.
you don't need a lot of stuff. Just a bit of sunshine and some chemistry and you're good. Yeah. And you can make some really cool things happen. So
I think my world's gonna change. Now I've got into the dark room printing. Luckily I've got the gentleman who gave me all the dark room gear, he's coming over on a Saturday to maybe advise me where I'm going wrong, this sort of stuff. And he's been doing it like 3 decades.
It's not about going wrong, it's about learning.
Yeah, exactly.
It,
right? Yeah.
It's about, you know.
Yeah.
Because how else do we get better? It's only by failing.
Yeah.
You have to, in a way, you have to make those mistakes, and you kind of have to make those mistakes yourself because somebody can say to you, oh, that you're doing that wrong, but until you've done it and realized actually what has gone wrong with that whole process, you can't really fix it, or you won't have that understanding of going, oh right, okay. So it's just about changing one little variable each time, and eventually you'll get there. You know, it's just about experimenting and trying something out.
Yeah, too right.
So
one of the things I noticed is, so you also do like project work for schools and things like that. Can you tell me about that then?
Yeah,
so what do you do with them?
Yeah, so I as part of my business, I kind of have 2 different strands, 2 main umbrella strands. So I have education and I have entertainment. So the education side of things covers everything from small, intense, like full day workshops with maybe like 4 people maximum. I have various ones that look at pinhole, or just as a general intro to analog, or ones where you can build a camera from a kit, that kind of thing. And then I thought, actually, what would be really nice, because part of what I love is about inspiring people to go, oh, wow, you know, this is just so cool that we've got all these options available to us, you know.
Yeah.
One of the nice things about that is is really sort of like showing people and seeing the penny drop for the first time, seeing, you know, people's eyes go, wow, oh my God, you know, light up, seeing it come to life in front of them. So I thought, well, kids are great for this. Mm-hmm. You know, they really do enjoy seeing these things happen in front of their eyes and kind of get into grips with it. So I designed a workshop where I would go into schools and I deliver it sort of like an hour and a half workshop session with like 12, 15 kids on like a rotor system through the day, where I teach them how to create a cyanotype sun print. So it's about which covers the chemistry side of photography, and showing them how obviously negative, positive works, creating photograms. You literally don't even need a camera and you can make a photograph, you know, how simple it is, really. For them to see that chemical reaction take place and then go away with something at the end, I think is always really important. And also to show them how to build like a pinhole viewer. So not even, you know, a camera really, but a viewer so that they can understand a bit more about the physics of light and how that works as well. And again, it's just really cool because it gives them a chance to see the world upside down and kind of blows their little tiny minds, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
So as part of that, I was going into schools, and I do still do that into community centres or groups, wherever there's a need for it, festivals, all sorts of things. But I thought actually what would be nice is if I created a kit, so I can make your own kit. So it incorporates both parts of that. So you're making your own cyanotype sun prints and you're also building a pinhole viewer. So I've made that into an analog adventurers kit, which I now have on Etsy, which is cool. So that's my first foray into delivering a fully sort of like crafted product, if you like. So it's kind of the culmination of a couple of years work, really, of me going, how do I bring this sort of to the masses almost? So it's really, it's been a dream for a long time actually to try and bring something like that to market, you know, for makers and creators and kids to get involved with, or, you know, for a photographer or for somebody who's vaguely interested even in image making. It's quite good fun, and you know, it's sort of like a little bit of an alternative way of looking at photography and looking at the world generally.
That's so cool. Yeah. So there's a few of us that obviously I don't even know what was it called, the cyano?
It's called a cyanotype. So cyan, okay, as in blue. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you know, we have magenta and yellow and cyan. So it's called a cyanotype. Because it at the end you get a blue and white print, so it's a very beautiful vibrant blue. Basically it starts off a different color. You coat the chemical onto paper or onto fabric or anything that's kind of porous, really, and then you can lay either objects on top of it, which would then be called a photogram, or you could lay literally negatives on top of it. So for example, the ones that I used that I shot as large format, that was how I made cyanotypes from those. And so wherever you have an object ends up white, if your paper is white or your fabric is white, and wherever there isn't an object and wherever there's chemical, that reacts with UV light. So obviously something like daylight, or not something like daylight itself is UV light, but you can obviously also get UV lamps and things. And so the chemical reaction that happens between the chemical and the UV light changes the colour of that chemical as it's creating this exposure. And then when it's finished making the exposure, you take the objects off or you take the negative off, and then you literally wash it off in water, and that fixes the print. Okay. So so basically you end up with a blue and white print once you've washed off the residual chemicals that haven't been, you know, exposed.
Okay.
So, that's how you create a cyanotype sun print.
Oh, that's very good. What, how different is a photogram then?
So a photogram basically means laying an object on top rather than a negative. So you're capturing the shadow of an object, if you like. It's also, this process is also the reason that blueprints are called blueprints.
For cyan.
Because they're blue, yeah. So before we had things like photocopiers and fax machines and all that kind of thing, I mean, there wasn't the way of making hundreds of copies of architectural building, you know, design. for all your builders. It was like, well, what would they do? They'd all have to look at one image that the architect had literally drawn by hand. So, but with this process, once this had been created, they were like, well, we can make as many copies as we like, literally like a vintage photocopier almost. You make one copy, you lay it over the paper that's been coated with the chemicals. You can literally do that as many times as you like and make as many copies of it as you like. So that's why they're called blueprints.
God, so you've taught me something there. That's amazing.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Yeah, no, this is awesome. Because, like I say, a lot of us don't have this experience. So,
I'm very pleased to hear that, Andrew. And the first person who kind of actually put together a photographic, what was be classed as a photographic book, was a woman called Anna Atkins, and she was the daughter of a scientist who basically had developed this process in conjunction with a couple of other photographic pioneers. And Anna herself, she was really interested in botanical specimens, so she used the cyanotype process as a way of recording all of these beautiful varieties of plant and botanical life, and basically preserving those into a book. And obviously you can make as many copies of those as you wanted, you know, after ongoing sort of thing. So she created all of these amazing cyanotypes and then put them all together, and that became the first photographic book,
really. Wow.
So yeah, she was pretty awesome. So yeah, you'll have to check out Anna Atkins' work. She's fabulous.
Yeah, I will do. I always think it's nice to know about some of the masters. So I bought Ansel Adams' books, and I did the dark room, I got the print book out, and I was like looking at his enlarger, and I was like, it's just amazing how big it was. I mean, he was a very, very lucky guy, but he was talented. And I actually put a screenshot of the book on the other day because he said one really profound thing that's still true in photography now, that the visualization of the photo is the most important aspect. And it's like, yeah, the technology or how you do it and all this doesn't matter. It is a big process, especially in print and film, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, to a certain extent, I think that is true. But I also think we make a choice with the medium that we choose to shoot it in. You know, because if you were to shoot an image using your large format camera on film or your digital camera, you're going to get a very different look print, aren't you? So you're making a choice about which materials and which tools you choose in order to create that image. But you're the person who's seeing that image in the first place. Like at the weekend, I was walking through the lake. So I popped there for a couple of days, which was lovely. And it's been a long time since I've had a chance to go to the lake. So that was really nice. But I was walking through sort of like a woodland path, and there's just such beautiful light there, and I really wanted to stop and get this particular shot, and I couldn't get it. It just wasn't working, and I actually felt like quite upset about it, because it's like this thing you have to do. Like I felt like, oh my god, I just need that shot. I could see it, you know, in my mind's eye, but I couldn't quite get it. So that sort of haunted me for the last three or four days. I've just been thinking about it, but you know, never mind, c'est la vie. These things, you know, another one will come up.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm sure. And when I do finally get it, it'll make it all the more special. So
I agree with you. You've also said that you do a travelling booth then. So how does that work with everything you do then?
So I mentioned, obviously, that I have the sort of education side of things, and I also have the entertainment side. So in terms of when I was setting up the business, I never really went in thinking this is exactly how it's going to be. It was more I want to work with analog processes, and I will develop and be flexible about how that works and evolves over time. So it's ended up, you know, evolving to the sort of like point that it is at the moment, where I have the education side. But I also need to, you know, because I have to make this as a sustainable business. This is my only source of income. This is my full-time job. So the entertainment side of things is another really lovely way of being able to add some variety to it and to be able to offer something a bit different for people as well. So I shoot weddings as a wedding photographer using hybrid. So I'll shoot with digital, but I'll also shoot using film on various different formats, 35mm or medium format. And instant as well. I tend to use a lot of that as well. And I really love being able to sort of incorporate all of those sort of different aesthetics into the day. The other part of what I do with that is I have a small vintage caravan called Rosie. She's very cute. And I converted her so that she can be used as a caravan obscura, like a camera obscura, but she's a caravan, obviously, which I'll tell you about in a minute. But I also use her as a traveling photo booth. So a lot of photo booths are sort of like the plastic pop-up thing, you know. But I wanted something that felt a little bit more authentic, shall we say, and really... it was all about actually you hire me as well as a vintage photographer to come along and shoot using the instant films, using my old cameras from the like 80s and 90s and that kind of thing, rather than it being a computer, you know, in a box, in a plastic white box. So I use Rosie for, as I say, like as a traveling caravan photo booth for weddings or celebrations or events or festivals or all sorts of things like that. And also as a caravan obscura, which means, I don't know if you've obviously come across the term.
I've only heard of it, but I have no knowledge of it.
It's basically a big pinhole camera, in a way. So I use Rosie as basically a big pinhole camera and say, come inside and sit inside inside a pinhole camera and you can see outside, world, inside, upside down. Which again is a nice way of demonstrating the physics of light, and it was one of the very early Victorian forms of entertainment. They tended to build on big estates, you know, camera obscuras, so that people could be entertained by the magic of how this all worked, and you could see down to the village, you know, and all the village people upside down. It was pretty cool, a way of seeing what you owned. There's a famous one in Edinburgh, a camera obscura. There are lots of them around. You can basically make a camera obscura out of more or less any light tight space. I mean, it doesn't even have to be really light tight like a dark room would be. As long as you're cutting out most of the ambient light, you can still generally see an image, which is why it's really nice to be able to go. I've got a lens I've designed that I put in the front of the caravan, pull down the blinds and black out the rest of it as much as it's possible, and then you're able to see an image. So it's, again, like I say, it's a nice way of being able to demonstrate how that works, really, and sort of tie it all together. So she's a very small caravan. She's only like 10 feet long, but there's a small toilet in there as well. And if you take the toilet out, I turn that into like a mini dark room. So you could be in the mini dark room in the toilet, because it's got a little fold down sink as well, you see. So she's kind of got everything you need, really, which is nice.
Yeah.
Do you know what I said about making a photo anywhere? There you go. You literally can.
I think that's the thing, though, isn't it? You've got the knowledge and you understand the entire process, where people like myself and others won't be starting at that point. It's like, I don't know, when you first pick up a film camera, you're like, well, how's it work? And it's it's a stupid question, because
it's not a stupid question, because if you've not done it before, you're not going to know.
If you've had a digital camera,
you?
The concept's exactly the same. It's just a different storage method in my eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, to children, you know, for anybody born after, you know, 2000 or 90, you know, late 90s or whatever, it's new technology to them, because they've never had it before. So we're all learning along together, and there's nothing to be afraid of or worried about. And if it goes wrong, does it really matter? It doesn't really matter, does it? You just try again, have another go, change a variable, try it out, or come and do one of my workshops, or buy one of my little kits, and there you go. You see, that's why I do that, because it helps other people to understand, oh, okay, and you suddenly get it, and it's like, ah, oh, fantastic. And then this whole world of possibilities opens up. Sounds like you're doing really well anyway. You're already in the dark room and making prints and things.
Yeah, I like to really, really challenge myself. I mean, like I said on my last podcast, I think, I shot film at the first ever wedding I went to. Because to me, it's totally irrelevant. I choose equipment because of the quality I want to get out of them. And you're right that there was very different looks. And this is what I think people would struggle to understand is it's the film that gets you the unique look and colours. You can put the camera in the bin and it's totally irrelevant, isn't it?
What kind of film do you tend to use? What medium do you enjoy shooting with?
The Bronica is just, amazing.
Mm-hmm. It's a very different experience, isn't it, shooting with a medium format from a 35mm?
And I've shot mainly colour, which, it's probably the same really for my 35mm as well, because I came in...
Have you done any slides?
No, I didn't even know what it was till a couple of months ago.
Okay, do your listeners
probably
know?
Not, no, because I've never
what slide film is. Maybe tell them about what you found out then, Andy. What have you found out?
As far as I know, slides different chemicals, and the whole idea with it was you're gonna have to use that in say really good light. So you're talking of ISO 50 stuff, and.
You have to be quite
very precise. Yeah, it's nowhere near as forgiving as other film. Well, that's literally all I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, honestly, there's not much more that you kind of really need to know. You know, you have colour negative or black and white negative, but you can also have slide film. So slide film would be where you see the image already as a positive. So you probably will have seen over the years, you know, you have like a slide carousel, you know, maybe the
I don't know anyone. No? I have to rely on the internet for this stuff.
Anyway, it's you would perhaps process it. There's E6 chemicals, so C41 would be your chemicals for colour negative. But then obviously you've got black and white chemicals, all sorts of different things for different parts of the process. But essentially, slide film, you're getting it as straight out of processing. You get it as a positive image as opposed to a negative image, which you would then invert to convert to make it into an image that would be as we would see it with our eyes, if you like, as a positive image. So that's it. That's all you need to do. Have you processed your own?
I've only done it once with a friend. So... it was perfect, but that's only because my friend was there, I think. Mm. We were both in the same dark room together, you see, so it was hard work because the film had a little like a fold on it, so it wouldn't go on the reel. And so I had to pass it to him. He tried it and it's like, oh god, did his best as he could. And then I think I'd be all right with the timing and stuff because that's just procedure. And obviously now I've done the prints. Yeah.
Recipe.
To be honest, I just guess it all anyway.
Doesn't matter. Honestly, you don't need to, I think, like I said before.
People said about the temperature and I was like, I don't care. I'm just going to try it. It's just ridiculous.
Well, especially black and white. As you say, it's very forgiving, especially if you're starting with something like an HP5 from Ilford. That's I bloody love that film. It's so great. You chuck it into pretty much any camera and, you know, away you go. In terms of your temperature for processing, you don't need to worry about it. With colour processing, you're looking more at like something within half a degree, which I always felt was like, that's too close for me. I'd rather be able to like, you know, misjudge it by 2 degrees and it's fine, you know, one way or the other. Because actually it's a lot of leeway. And it gives you such a lot of latitude as well, which means you'll be able to really see the highlights and the tones in the dark areas of the image as well. It's just fantastic what you can pull back from it, as opposed to if you shoot the same shot with a digital camera, in terms of being able to actually bring out the detail that's in perhaps, let's say you're shooting in a room, but you've also got a window in
where the meter
in. And what's outside the window. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But with film, you're a lot more likely to be able to save detail that's from outside the window because of the latitude of the film itself. So that information's already is still there, even if it looks a little bit overexposed to begin with. You should be able to bring that out with a bit of dodging and burning, which you may be doing.
No, I've literally only been in twice. So okay. I understand
that. So you dodging and burning. Yeah, it's basically just using, you know, a mask or your hand or basically a piece of card or something to expose some parts of the image for longer to light than other parts of the image. That's pretty
much it. I was watching I read a little bit of the Ansel Adams book, and he said he used like a little wire, thinnest wire he can, then a little bit of say circular card, and the back of it has to be black so it doesn't reflect light back. Yeah,
so it's not reflecting.
So yeah, I was thinking of maybe trying that this weekend.
Yeah, and it you wave it around so that you kind of keep it soft, so you've not got like a whole harsh edge of the piece of card. So you wouldn't just hold the piece of card and hold it still over the top of one area of the image. You want to kind of like keep it moving. You kind of basically just sort of like blending the edges, if you like, to keep it nice and soft. But it means that you can expose one part of the image for longer than the other part of the image, and in order to be able to bring out the detail that might be in.
Yeah, because that's definitely what I want to do. I can see from, I think I've done 8 prints maybe in total. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, good.
I mean, I'm really happy with them because I didn't have a focus finder because I didn't even know what one was. I still don't even know how to use it yet. So it was just guessing by eyesight, and my eyesight's pretty poor. And they came out quite grey, and I thought, right, now I can understand why you have to do this dodging stuff. But obviously I've got no one around me. So
you might also want to use some filters. Yeah, so if you're finding it's a little bit, when you say grey, in terms of like they're not being that much contrast.
Not enough contrast and not dark in the shadow sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So you might want to look at using filters, because you can use filters to bring out, to create contrast, and there's different levels of contrast. So your filters that would fit into like a little filter holder that'll sit just above or below your enlarger, depending on your enlarger, it will depend on where the little cradle for the filters sits. But you'll be able to get filters that will sit in there. There'll be various different shades of red, usually, and they will create, to a greater or lesser extent, some contrast from, so your darker areas will become darker, your lighter areas will become lighter, as you raise the amount of contrast that you've got. So if you find that you've got a bit of a grey image, I'd always suggest do lots of test strips, because you don't want to be using whole sheets of paper to create, you know, each time, because that's quite wasteful. So, you know, cut one piece of 10x8 paper up into like 6 or 8 strips or what have you. And then that's all you need, because if you've got your piece of card, you can expose it and then just move the card across it at, you know, sort of 2 second intervals or half second intervals. 5 second intervals, depending on, you know, just to give you a starting point, and then you can go between 3 seconds and 4 seconds is my it looks quite nice. So then it means that you've taken, again, you've checked on what the variables are, and you've gone, right, so I can eliminate everything above and below between 3 and 4 seconds. So we're looking at 3 and 4 seconds, and then you could do a print at the full print and then work out, oh, okay, that area is a bit too light, that area is a bit too dark, or maybe in general it's a bit grey, so I'll add a layer of filter. So I'll put a filter in that, maybe a 1 or a 2 or something, you know? and sort of build it up from there and see what
Yeah, that's true. Luckily, the guy gave me this stuff. Also, it has a colour head on the enlarger. But obviously, I had no idea what to do. So I was messaging friends saying, what do I do? Oh, yep. Just start like this. And
there's lots of resources. Honestly, like YouTube's amazing. There's so much online and the community in general. That's the other thing that I've really loved about getting back into film and setting up the business and all of the things I do now has been finding that community, and that actually there's so many people who are, they're very generous with their knowledge and their experience, and you know, kind of just want to pass on the reason that we love doing this is because actually we just love doing it, so we want other people to enjoy it as much as we do, and I think that's a really important sort of like way of helping that community grow, which will make it hopefully stronger for everybody, because you know, we've got actually, I think, like, you know, Paul's saying they've got like 180 films now, you know, that are actually created, and it's fabulous, isn't it, you know, that we've got all this choice and variety, and actually it's not the argument of digital versus film is not there anymore, or it shouldn't be, because it's not about saying one's better than the other, it's about saying you've got options for all of it, so you know, that's pretty awesome, right? Just choose what it is that you want to use for that particular project. You know, I would never go and shoot a sports event using film, you know, because it's just not really appropriate. I'm sure there are some people out there who do, but I wouldn't want to do that. And similarly, I don't like shooting a whole wedding on film, but I do really love, you know, incorporating that as, you know, a good chunk of what I'm delivering in terms of images, because there's something really special about that. And because I don't shoot very much, I like to keep numbers very small, so I really get to know the couple. And there's something really special about going, I know exactly each of those images that I shot on my film camera, and then I take it home, and then I put it into, you know, my tank in the darkroom, and I hand process it. And there's a lot of love and, you know, kind of, there's a lot of me that goes into creating those images. So there's something a bit more special about I think. But yeah, I wouldn't want to shoot the whole day like that, because, you know, I just wouldn't be able to gather the amount of images that are, you know, sort of expected now, and that the couple would potentially want. You know, not every image you're necessarily wanting to spend all of that energy on. You know, sometimes it's like, well, they might just want some of those, you know, candids, you know, and so digital is perfect for that. So, you know, let's use the digital. We've got that option.
No, I agree with you. I think they both can be used wherever. What would you say your favourite format is then?
That's such a hard question. I don't, you know, I'm really sorry. I don't think answer it. Just because I love them all. Like, I definitely shoot more 35mm. Simply because the cameras are smaller and more convenient, and I like to be able to always kind of have at least a camera with me. So, you know, it makes sense to put my little Olympus XA, which is a tiny little camera, you know, in my pocket, you know, if I'm going out, and then I've got, you know, I've got a bit of film in that. Excellent. Which I wouldn't necessarily be able to do taking my large format pinhole out with me, you know, that's something that take up a whole backpack sort of thing, and not in a bad way, because, you know, again, you're making a choice. It's like, well, if I'm in the mood to take that out, or if I actually find that I have some time to go out and shoot, I mean, to be honest, Andy, this is like, that is my biggest nemesis. It's like trying to make sure that I actually have time to go and shoot. So time to do the thing that I actually love doing is very difficult when you're running a business, because you have to be everything to everybody, and, you know, you have to cover everything, don't you, yourself. So actually, the time that I actually get chance now to go and be shooting is very, very slim. But if I do kind of go, oh, in 3 months, I'm going to have a Wednesday afternoon where I've got, you know, 3 hours to go out, then I might plan that, you know, that day, that afternoon, and go, right, I'm going to take my pinhole camera out, and I'm going to take, you know, this box of film, and maybe three sheets of that, and my dark bag, and, you know, and kind of like really plan it almost as like a mini holiday. I see those times as like my mini
holidays. Yeah, that's good. Time's precious to me as well. I'm a dad, you see, so everything I do. So even tonight I was playing outside with my daughters playing Tig. So I've come in, they needed a bath, I needed a bath. I had to run downstairs to get set up.
I'm glad this is all audio. No, it's only like you had a bath. We're okay.
It's
then.
Just crazy. You work all day. I like to spend weekends with my girl, so time is precious. So you plan your days, and I think you get more out of it.
Yeah. And it'll be really. I don't know if this is obviously appropriate for you, Andy, but perhaps there's ways that you can incorporate your newfound love of what you're doing with your girls,
and
bring them into that experience.
I always get
them involved in it. I mean, this is you know exactly what I think is the most special part of it. It's like being able to share those experiences. Like I always remember making the, like I said, these photos with my dad. That's something that we have as a really lovely connection, you know. And that's never going to disappear. That's always going to be my starting point of my love for doing what I do. So, you know, I think there's something very special about that, really. It's just fabulous sort of like seeing how enthusiastic that, you know, children can be about this and having that really special time, you know, to bond and have that
connection.
Right,
I'm going to try and get them in my eldest, probably try and get her in the dark room and maybe do a print with me. And then I might try doing like the photograms with them as well, because they like flowers and leaves and that. So
yeah,
I'm up for trying.
Absolutely.
So fantastic. Although you haven't got a favourite format, have you got a favourite film then you use?
I love my HP5. It was one of the very first films I used, and it's always been so forgiving. I really love using it in workshops. So when I'm introducing people to film, it's like if you use this, you're gonna get some images. You have to do something incredibly bad in order to not get images out of it, to be honest. And I just equally, I really love how Ilford have they've really hung on in there, and they're fantastic people. The company, there's only like 200 people there, it's an international company, you know. They are the people who make black and white. I was very lucky to go and spend a day going around the factory and seeing how they processed it all and how they create it and the manufacturer and the scientists. And they've all been there for like 30, 40 years. Wow. You know, the people who there, it's job for life, you know. It was like they were there because they really loved it, and they really saw being part of that as being part of something a bit bigger, you know. And they went through obviously really terrible times and what have you, so it's fantastic to see how they've still hanging on in there, and it's now growing and it's getting bigger and things. So from the company perspective, I really admire what they've done. Same with Kodak, they've done brilliantly well to hang on in there again. It's been really good to see that. In terms of the film, I love it because it's, like I say, it's so forgiving. And because also we live in Britain and it's an ISO 400, you've got a lot of flexibility there. You can shoot it at 400, which is what you would call box speed, because that's the number that's obviously on the box. But you can do something where you call push or pull the film as well. So it's a technique where you can shoot it at a different ISO. So ISO is obviously how quickly the film reacts with light, quickly or slowly it reacts with light. So you could shoot HP5 at 200 ISO or at 800 ISO or at 1600 ISO if you want to, and still process it and get an image, you know. It's got a lot of, as I said before, latitude. And it's kind of like a sort of bomb-proof film, really. so that would be one that I would always suggest, especially for somebody starting out. That's a really good one to start with. the FP4s lovely as well, because once you've had a go with HP5, if you want something with a bit of finer grain, then that's a ISO 125. So you're going to get a finer grain, which can be really lovely to, if you're not a fan of seeing lots of grain, you might want to go towards something a bit more like a 50 or a 100 ISO, you know, that kind of thing. So those I really love. And in terms of colour, I love Portra, Kodak Portra.
Isn't so it? Lovely. Yeah. It's all I've ever bought for the Bronica. Amazing.
So that's what I shoot with my Rolly Cord, my Rolly Flex, for obviously, especially for things like engagement shoots and weddings and things like that. So when I'm shooting anything colour, I always have some, you know, Portra 160 or what have you, you know.
No, that's cool to hear, sounds like we've got similar things in mind there. I think so. What obviously one of the main reasons I come across you was through your podcasting. So, Rachel is heavily involved with the Sunny 16 podcast. I'll obviously put a link in here. How did you get involved with
Thank
it?
Very much. Oh, well, they rang me up and badgered me, and they wouldn't leave me alone. I have to say that, because hopefully they'll listen to this and then they will laugh. There's two chaps called Aid and Graham who set up Sunny 16 podcast, and it's analog photography. It's all specifically on analog photography, but as we've discussed today, Andy, you know, it's quite wide ranging as a subject, and we're just on show 112 at the moment, so we release one show a week basically. And I came in at, I think, episode 45 or something like that. Maybe it's a little bit more. Maybe it's early 50s, something like that. Anyway, on Instagram, they'd followed me and I'd followed back. And eventually Graham had sent me a message saying, we love what you've been doing. We've been seeing all this cool stuff you've been doing with Rosie, the caravan, and the education side of things as well. It'd be really nice to have you on as a guest, because we do the UK Analog Photography podcast. So in the end, we arranged to do an interview similar to what yourself and myself are doing now. And so I went on the show as a guest, as an interviewee. And then I happened to be going to Shanghai a couple of months later, and they said, would you come back and do like a sort of field report, tell us a little bit about what it was like shooting in China, because I've never been anywhere like that before. And it was a fantastic experience. It was a friend of mine who was living out there for a year, you see, so I'll probably never get a chance to do it again. It was lovely to go and see the place for the week. And so, like I say, so very different from the UK, really. So I went back on the show, did a little field report, told them about my experiences of shooting in Shanghai. And then I got a call from Aid saying, actually, we're coming up to like a year. They've been creating the podcast for a year at this point. We'd like to sort of shake things up a little bit, and we like what you're doing. It'd be really nice to have you on board as part of the team. So that's when I came on board full time with Sunny 16. So I've been co-hosting with Aid and Graham since then, really. So like I say, we're at show 112 now. So getting to show 100 was quite a big deal, because it was like, wow, we actually did that. it's a big undertaking. As obviously, I'm sure you know yourself, Andy. You know, it's putting something out there regularly actually committing to doing that is a big thing to do, and especially if you're doing it on your own, because I know that they'd found it, you know, difficult doing that as with the two of them, you know, over time, you know, 1 week you might be off with work or with you know holiday or whatever, you know, or you might be sick, so trying to kind of keep that going, it helped make it a little bit more sustainable. And I think also it was the reason that I said yes, really, to the guys, is because I liked how they were very down to earth about things. You know, I felt in general photography maybe got all a little bit too serious, and that it was all about who's got the biggest lens and the most megapixels and all of that kind of thing. And that's just not really my style, because I'm much more about, well, you know, anybody can do this if, you know, if they want to have a go. And, you know, I'm much more of a champion for the underdog. Let's give it a whirl. It doesn't matter if it messes it up, you know. So I like the fact that they didn't take themselves too seriously. And it was all very tongue-in-cheek, and there's generally quite a bit of swearing and all sorts of things, funny things that happen. But it's really lovely. It gives me a chance to, you know, in a way, hang out with my friends, you know, even though we live in completely opposite ends of the country and what have you. It's nice to do that. And I think in general, it was also important to show that there are women involved in the industry, especially in film photography. And I take my responsibility for that very seriously, to show that, women are definitely a big part of this, even if, you know, even if maybe Nikon didn't always realize that they are. Okay, so a bit of a low blow, I suppose. But still, you know, there have been various things over the years. We don't need to go into all of that now, but it's just nice to know that, in a way, there are women around doing sort of like fantastic work, and perhaps sometimes it's an opportunity for me to help highlight some of those voices that aren't always heard. So I really enjoy doing that, and hopefully being able to help contribute to that side of it.
Yeah,
well,
that's really nice. I think it's actually quite a nice medium as well, isn't it? Because I think it's so different. So I started off blogging, which is okay, but then, you know, words can be interpreted differently. I think if you hear someone's voice, you can offer a bit more emotion, maybe.
Yeah, there's definitely subtle nuances that you can get across in audio that you wouldn't necessarily be able to do in quite the same way via the written word, unless perhaps you are a creative writer or that's naturally something that really comes easily to you. I know it doesn't to me at all. So I find it much easier to talk. You probably had noticed
that's all right. I'm exactly the same.
Andy. and I also love listening to people, you know, finding out more about people. And honestly, the really good thing about podcasts is you can be listening to them and absorbing that information whilst you're busy doing other stuff too. So, you know, it's a way of being able to kind of catch up on something or learn something new or just generally have a bit of a laugh, you know, whilst you're, you know, maybe doing very boring chores or something. It can help lighten other areas of your life, I think, or inform you or what have you. So, you know, it's a good way of being able to use perhaps extra time. You know, we were talking about time and how valuable time is, that, you know, if you've got a commute to work or something, you can listen to a podcast. Even if you're in the car, you know, even if you're driving, you can still listen to a podcast. You couldn't necessarily read articles or a book or what have you. So that it opens up
This has totally changed me, because I had to start commuting to work, so it's about a 40-minute journey every day. And I only came across podcasting about 13 weeks ago. I set up, I think, 1 week later. So I was listening to...
You don't hang about.
Oh, no, no, no.
Definitely
don't. If you're going to do something, you just do it. That's how I was with film.
Excellent.
So that's why I push it, and, you know, I'm the only person I know who blogs, the only person I know who does podcasts. Probably do video one day if my computer copes, but I've had issues. So, you know, it's like you say, you work to what you can do, but it was amazing because I had to learn about audio. I've never done this in my life. Luckily, I know lots of people now. So I've took advice from some videographers about sound. So that's why I've got a mic that works a bit better than normal. Taught myself how to use like Audacity to edit my sounds. I always do my own artwork and little writing. And I'm a massive person of writing my own text. So although I quote Ansel Adams, that's probably two quotes I've ever quoted in 3 years. I believe in being an artist and creating your own. So the only thing I'm really rubbish at is music, so I can't do my own intros. Yeah, but it annoys me.
That's all right. You know, you don't have to.
Yeah, it really annoys me because I want to do it all.
Oh, frustrates you.
But I know I'm not great at anything one particular. I'm just, I feel like I'm all right at some stuff.
That's okay. There are other, you know, other sources that you can find for adding in the music if you need to. As much as I'm sure it is frustrating that you can't do all of the things. Sometimes we can't do all of the things, and I guess that's a lesson that is a hard lesson to learn, but we learn it as we get as we get older, I think, because we suddenly realise, oh God, I can't do everything. But I fully understand what you say with that. I find it very difficult to delegate, to let things go, and especially when it's your own business and all that kind of thing. You know, you have to be, you are in control of everything, because there's no other choice, you know, to start with. So that when it comes to the point where you have to start letting certain things go or change or what have you, that can be quite difficult. At least that's my experience. Some people, I'm sure, could do it without turning a hair, but I'm like, no, it's mine. Hanging on.
No, yeah, I think that's a personality thing, isn't it? I mean, one of the guys I've worked quite closely with on a couple of weddings, he's so casual on a wedding day, it's unbelievable, and he's just turned up and said, right, Andy, just basically do what you want. Literally just says that. So I just wander off. And
that could be good and a bad thing, because... because you're like, great, I've got all this freedom, but equally sometimes people can need a bit of direction.
Yeah,
if you just say, just do whatever you like, it can be, well, is that right?
And it's worked wonderful. It's balance, so you know, we've paired up really well, so it's give me the confidence. And then one day you just turn around and said, can you help me out? I need someone to help do a photo booth. And it was like 2.5 hours away on a Saturday night. And I went and did it. I've never done it before. Didn't know what to expect. He literally showed me his camera within 5 minutes during my dinner hour, which I was trying to eat in front of him. And he went, yeah, everyone really enjoyed it. You did a good job, mate. And he's asked me 3 more times.
There you go.
And so it was good fun. So
nice.
It's fun.
Excellent.
No, thank you. Well, it's funny you're talking about podcasting. In my queue, I'm on episode 22 of yours, Sunny 16. Yeah.
Oh, Sunny 16, are you?
Yeah, so if...
You're on episode 22. Oh, gosh. Well, that was
why rubbish,
so,
yeah.
No, I was going to say, please don't listen to my first episode. It's awful. It's honestly, it's the most cringeworthy thing ever. I absolutely hated listening to it. Honestly, I find it so nerve-wracking still.
Do you?
Each week. I
really don't bother me.
I get myself right worked up, I do. I just want it to be good. You know, I care and I do want to be able to express myself properly. And sometimes it doesn't quite come out as you hope it's going to come out, and it can be difficult. It's always a nerve-wracking thing to me to go in and do, and then afterwards I'm like, oh, I really enjoyed that, it was great chatting to the guys and chatting to the guests and things, and I absolutely love it. It's a constant internal battle for me.
I know what you mean. I'm like that with other things. I think the it's a big thing to do, but I think once you do it, you you just sort of get addicted. I mean, I did one on Monday night, and I think the one I did last week was probably like Thursday. So I've done three in less than 10 days.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you see. Yeah, there's a few other analog photography podcasts that have popped up over the last sort of few months, and there's a chap called Mike Gutterman, and he runs one called the Negative Positives podcast. And he, I think he got to sort of like show 100 in the same time as it took us to do 12 episodes or something. It was just crazy. Like he was doing so many. He's actually got a co-host now, a chap called Andre. He works for CineStill. He was on an internship there, and they kindly sent over their new monobath, which is, if you're doing hand processing, you would usually do a develop, then a stop, and then a fix. But a monobath does all of those. It's absolutely, honestly, yeah. I was like, this is like witchcraft. It's incredible. It's just magical. And you basically just pour one lot of chemical in, and it does everything. It's I don't know how. Honestly, I don't know, but it's brilliant. So they're not the only company that create monobaths. There are others, but they recently launched one, the DF96, and so Andre sent that over from the States for me, so I could have a go with one of the first from the batch sort of thing. So that's been a lot of fun, and I was like sending him all these questions. Oh, can you do this with it? Can you do that with it? And he was like, give it a go. I was like, yeah, I'm gonna do it anyway, even if you didn't say give it a go. I was like, I'm gonna give it a go. so that was really, really good, good fun. And again, it's like I'm trying something new out. This is always interesting.
I think that's some of the best thing, is getting to know different people like yourself, because we get a bigger community, and then everyone helps everyone. This isn't like you're in business to go against each other, right?
No. The more people who are interested in the industry in general, in photography in general, it's giving more people voices, isn't it? It's being able to show us, you know, billions of different perspectives on things. And in terms of analog photography, it's meaning that it's creating a much stronger industry that can grow and can evolve and can actually, bring itself back to probably not what it was originally, because not everybody's going to be shooting film, but it'll still be a niche product, but it'll be a strong niche, I think. And I think that's really important, because then it will mean that if the manufacturers see that demand is there, then they will eventually get to the point where they're supplying that demand, because there's money to be had, because there's people who are interested and want to buy products, and, you know, and then the engineers amongst us and the makers and the creatives and the, you know, anybody who's kind of like, oh, I'll try this or what have you, they're then starting to create things like the Pixelator to solve the problem of what do we do with, you know, our huge negatives when we've not all got big dark rooms at the local college anymore, you know, that kind of thing. How do we deal with this now in a digital age? So it gives other opportunities, I think, for growth, and a lot of hybrid work. I do a lot of hybrid work, especially because one of the main parts of photography that interests me is the idea of how it crosses, especially analog photography, crosses all the STEM subjects. So the science, technology, engineering, maths, and A for arts as well. So it's moved from being just STEM to being STEAM, and adding the A in as well, because it's got such a creative output. So you're literally using your chemistry and your physics, but your technology, if you're using things like, the phone apps for inverting images of negatives and creating that and then printing those out, you know, via Bluetooth. I mean, it's just amazing the things you can do now. Engineering, because, you know, you might be building a pinhole camera or a viewer or a camera for a kit or something. You're engineering something. Maths is always really important in photography, whether analog or digital, you know, working out your exposure times or your temperatures or all sorts of, or your distances, you know, if you're shooting with an old camera without without a coupled rangefinder, you know, so you're not necessarily going to know your distances. You might have to actually work that out. all the, so you know, that covers all of those, but gives you a very creative artistic output at the end. You're creating an image or an artwork in some way, shape or form. So yeah, I think that's a really important part of it for me. I really like working with organizations like the like Innovate Her and Liverpool Girl Geeks and what have you, because it shows especially women and girls that actually being part of those industries, you can easily be part of those without even realizing you're being part of them, you know, and it just sort of ignites a little bit of interest in it. And then suddenly, you know, they're coding, or suddenly they're, you know, building a camera or whatever, you know, and it's very cool to see that, that it's not this big scary thing, you know, that seems insurmountable from the outside. Suddenly you're doing it and you're hands on and it's like, oh, wow, actually I can do this.
Yeah, it's
that confidence a lot of the time.
I think the school thing is just, you know, absolute spot on. I was fortunate enough to work in a school about 4 years ago. And I just decided to set up my own computer club. So in the same vein, it was about getting kids that had never done computing, they'd always done technology, typing and absolute rubbish that schools taught up to the last few years. So I got in things like Raspberry Pis. Have you heard of that? Yeah. Yeah, and then And Arduino, and I got coding and playing these sort of games where you have to think how to move forward. And we got them working with LEDs. They were doing all sorts, and it was amazing. I mean, one of my best achievements I absolutely love and always remember is I taught her a year 10, so that's about a 14-year-old, binary.
Mm-hmm.
With maths, and then I'm taught in the same concept using some lights I'd borrowed from the science department, and he was then able to teach year six and sevens, and it was like, oh, it was so amazing. He just wanted to tell everyone, can I show you how that binary works? And I was like, bloody hell, he's got this.
That is such a fabulous feeling, isn't it? That, honestly, it's
yeah.
So nice.
So I think if I can get to the point where I know as much as yourself, I think I'd love to do it here. I'm on the east. I'm Lincoln.
Where is here, Andy? Where are you based?
Yeah. Luckily, I still work with schools as well for IT. So, and the schools that I do work with, I'm quite close to them. So. One of the kids, I lent a book on Python, which is a programming language. And the teachers actually said to me, if you get time, just take him out of the class and teach him. And to me, that's like, you know, he trusts me. And obviously the child looks up to you. Because I took in I've got another device. It's not as clever as an Arduino or a Raspberry Pi. It's called a Makey Makey. Have you heard of that? It's an amazing little thing. Two of the students from MIT invented it. It's basically a little thing where you plug in banana clips and you just use anything that conducts electricity. So you get a few simple commands like up and down, and then there's a bigger one where you can do up, down, left, right, space bar, all this sort of thing. So basically, we connected up like a banana or a apple, and we put a little old-fashioned game on. So say it's like a Mario thing. You press the banana and he jumps. And the kids are like, what?
Yeah, it's brilliant, isn't it? Yeah, it's fab. Do you know what you should do, Andy? You should look for your local maker community as well. We have got a really big maker community in sort of Liverpool and around like Northwest and what have you, and across the UK. I know that there's a lot of places and obviously abroad as well, US. But they very similar kind of things, you know. Well, people doing similar things, but in their own unique way, if you like, using plants as conductors.
Oh, e-textiles,
all sorts of things. They're really interesting. And it's very cool. So the things that you're talking about, I think that's probably another sort of like crossover community that you should speak to and get involved with, definitely. Because if you've already got the computing background, as well as it sounds like you have, then that would be a really good way of kind of incorporating your different loves for different things, I think.
It's nice because when I was speaking to Bob from the Street Photography magazine, we just got on so well. We've been chatting for maybe a year on and off, because he's from a quiet city as well. And I said, Lincoln's a really quiet city. So for me to do street photography is quite a big thing mentally. Literally, I'm the only person on the street with a camera. There might only be, you know, five people on the street. So it's obvious what I'm doing. And he was like,
I think in a way it's better, though, being obvious rather than being somebody with a big long lens who's hiding behind a, you know, a bollard sort of thing, looking like you're not trying to get a photo. I mean, I honestly, I can't talk because it's something I would love to be good at and that I would love to do more of, but it's terrifying, right? I was like, oh my God, it's too scary. But we had, there's a fantastic guy called Anil Mystery. He came on Sunday 16 podcast as a guest for us. And he's absolutely brilliant. Talked to us a lot about street photography and NASA as well. Sorry, I'm having to find out NASA's surname. I can't remember his surname at all. But both of them talked to us about, you know, doing street photography or shooting on the streets in a city, and how to approach it. And they have different ways of approaching it, but some really interesting, insightful tips as well. So I'd highly recommend at some point, I'm sure, if you're making your way through our past catalogue anyway, you'll come across them. But I think they're a bit more they're slightly more up to date
in
episode 24. but have a little listen, definitely, because there's some fantastic sort of like tips and things there. Or, you know, follow them on Twitter. I don't know if you're, you know, on there as well. And honestly, there's a great online community just to talk about all of these things that we all love about.
Yeah, you're dead right. You know, it's funny that you're from Liverpool. So were you born in Liverpool then?
No, I've been here. I've been here 18 years now.
it's almost one of my favourite places. Yeah, well.
Oh, it's such a great city. When were you here last?
God, quite a long time ago. Probably 10 years now, I think.
Okay, it's changed a lot because I came here in the year 2000. And then we got the Capital of Culture in 2008 and things changed a lot. Yeah. Both between 2000 and 2008 and then following 2008, obviously things changed again. And I'd say in the last two or three years as well, there's been like another leap forward sort of thing, if you like. So
it's funny because I did an analog project last year. Where I sent my camera off to random people around the country, and one of the ladies, Cassandra Coles, she's from Liverpool, and I'm a massive Liverpool fan from birth.
Ah.
Well, maybe not birth, but she said, I work at Anfield, and I was like, how weird is that? I've come across someone who works there. She's a lovely young lady.
Excellent. Well, there you go.
Yeah, because I want to meet all these people. There's a model I want to meet, and I formed a great relationship with a guy just above Edinburgh. So he's film. He's the guy who gives me tips on print and everything. So, really top guy.
Excellent.
Yeah, I think that's one of the best things about this sort of thing.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. Yeah, it's the thing that joins us all together, isn't it?
So, One thing I wanted to make sure you didn't get off lightly with was this is where I do like a drum roll, the random questions. Oh, wow. So you heard Paul's random questions.
Oh, random questions. Okay.
So your first one, nice easy one for you. Biro or fountain pen? I'm going to guess you're going to say fountain pen because you're very creative.
It's difficult because my husband bought me a really nice biro, and that's the one that I use every day now. So it's a special one. So actually, for creative flair, yes, I would say fountain pen. But actually, the one that I do use is a nice biro.
Very cool. So I couldn't use a fountain pen to save my life. They used to snap on me. I was terrible.
Oh God! When the ink cartridges would burst all in your bag and in your
I remember
pocket
them.
And oh my God! Yeah
I remember
everywhere.
Them at school. So no way. What is your idea for Dragon's Den? What's your pitch? What's your?
Oh my goodness! My idea for Dragon's Den.
I mean, I suppose for you, it could be your current business.
Well, no. I was going to say that, and I was like, "Is that cheating? If I just say what I'm doing now?" Oh, okay, then yes. It's my analog adventures kits, then the ones that I'm currently selling on Etsy. It would be really nice to get those out as a bigger.
Cool.
That'll be my Dragon's Den.
And your final one is Elvis alive? No. Straight no.
No, unfortunately not. Straight no. No,
shattered my dreams.
No, I don't believe so. No, I'm so sorry.
Two
are
reasons
you a very
I love
big
Liverpool.
Elvis fan, are you?
Beatles and Liverpool FC. So obviously, they had a massive influence on Elvis. From Elvis, they loved him. So yeah.
Of course, yeah.
Have you still got the museum there of Elvis?
I'm afraid not. Sorry.
Okay.
No, not as far as I know. There's the Beatles Museum, but not. I don't think the. Sorry, it's not one that I've come across. No. But you see, I live just off Penny Lane, so I'm submerged in it all the time.
It must be brilliant to be fair.
It's good.
Oh yeah.
The signs are
Strawberry Fields,
you know, the road
Lane.
Signs.
God, yeah.
you can't see which road you're on. You can't read them. I love the fact that like the barbershop's still here. Like we have a barbershop.
And there's the pub.
Penny Lane and stuff.
That they used to play in it there. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. There's two. There's Penny Lane
Where they
wine
used to
bar
play.
And there's the
W. It's quite I read a little bit about them, and it's quite interesting, really. What made me laugh was they used to play in the bathroom to practice because of the acoustics.
Oh, really?
Mental,
acoustics
isn't
it? In the bathroom are always good, right?
But there we go. So I want to put you got through them, yes. I wanted to end it there because I appreciate how long you've been on. I really do appreciate your time, Rachel. It's been great to have you on.
Oh, it's been lovely to chat, Andrew. And thank you very much for writing into the Sony 16 podcast as well, because obviously our paths may not have crossed for a little while if you hadn't done that. So it's lovely to you reach out to us as well.
If you want to just tell people where to go look at your work, and then I'll obviously put it in the show notes as well for you.
Sure. So, thank you very much, Andrew. That's great. So people can find me online. My website is littlevintagephotography.co.uk. And on social media, I'm generally, if you search for Little Vintage Photography, I should come up. On Instagram, I have two. One is obviously that, and the other one is the Vintage Caravan Photo Booth as well. And if you were interested in having a look at the kits that I've put together on Etsy as little vintage photo
That's wicked, so yeah. I'll make sure they're done for you. And my final question, which I bet you probably know is coming. Who would you like to see on the show next? Is there anyone you can think that you'd recommend?
Well, you see, I would probably say you'll have to chat to Graham, because he is a lure unto himself anyway. So he'll be a challenging guest, but in a lovely way. I think you should have a chat with Graham, my co-host.
Cool. Yeah.
That'd be great.
Well, thank you so much again, Rachel. I wish you all the best, and I'm sure the business will grow without a doubt.
Thank you. I'll keep plugging away. We will see how things go. But thank you very much. It's been lovely to chat. And
that'd be great.
Follow me on social media. That's, we'll keep in touch.
Really appreciate it. You take care.
Thank you very
much. Rachel. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
Well, folks, that's the end of another show. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I enjoyed making it. It's always great to have a guest on with me. Please do share the post and podcast show as much as you can where relevant. If you have time, please do not forget to review this on iTunes. Just hit the review button and give it 5 stars, please. It's always helpful. It's motivation for me to keep the show going, and I want to keep this going for as long as possible. And basically, I'd like to get lots of different and interesting people on here. So that's what I'm trying to do. Thank you again, and see you next time. Bye.